Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is...
It's January 22nd, 2023, and welcome to episode 263 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now. And my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
Here's Here is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, New Year's, old tech, and all that kind of fun stuff. I'm Paul Hagstrom, near Boston. I am joined today by four retro computing enthusiasts, the first of whom is Quinn Dunkey, up in the upper northwest region of Canada. Well, I guess lower left region of Canada, upper northwest of the continent. How are you?
Good. We just call it British Columbia, but your regional description was essentially accurate, so I appreciate that.
Okay.
Yes, but BC is such a small place.
It is. It's tiny, all tucked away down there.
Yeah, yeah. I know. You blink and you miss it.
All right. Also joining us, also from Canada, is Carrington Vanston in Toronto. How are you?
I'm fantastic. I'm not in BC, so I'm like lower... But
that's right.
BC is where we keep all the crinkly bits of Canada.
The crinkly bits, yes.
Yeah. You're somewhat easterly, but not very all the way easterly.
Right.
Yep. Also joining us is Earl Evans in Portland. How are you?
Hi. I'm doing well. I'm actually near Portland. I'm not technically in Portland.
Well, we're all near Portland.
Yeah, relatively speaking. If you're thinking about Saturn.
We're
right.
Jinx. Almost in Canada.
What are we even doing?
I think we're introducing also Michael Mulhern in Sydney.
Which is very near Saturn.
Yes.
And right. Just outside Portland.
How are you?
Again, from Saturn.
Yeah, just got to make sure you take the big bridge to get to Sydney from Portland. The small bridge will just get you to Canada.
So 2023 is off to a wonderful start. Very on topic, very well focused. Nobody's talked about the weather, but that's okay.
Oh, it's cold.
Well,
tell you about the weather.
I haven't seen what the weather's like. It was dark time when I got up and drove into work to do worky things, and haven't looked out a window since. So I'm assuming I have weather.
It's very large outside.
Yes. Mm. Herb in the chat says, "Happy Year of the Rabbit."
Yep. It's my year again.
Oh, are you a rabbit person? I think I'm monkey.
No comment.
Surprise.
So we have we've been kind of going through the years, you know, sort of corresponding to our episode numbers, and this would be the one for 1963. I didn't really look too hard into 1963 though. Did anyone else?
I looked, but there wasn't much. A lot of people took time off, it seems. Everything had already been invented. There was nothing new to do. Computing was done.
Yeah, it wasn't until 64 that they got inspired again, but 63 was a holiday.
But that's all right, because we have another topic that we can raise here, which is that you may recall that at the end of 2022, we lost cyber ears. Cyber ears went away. You know, we appreciate their having hosted
their audio. Yeah, they were fantastic.
But they are... no longer around, and so our audio is now on a different service, Libsyn, and we had to move everything. We also moved our website too, so we are...
You're saying we a lot there for the guy who did all the actual work.
Yeah.
But thank you for including us.
So rcrpodcast.com is now on basically a default WordPress template. But
huzzah.
it does what you need, you know. So one aspect of that though is that it... Well, this is also partly Libsyn. Oh yeah, well that this is all the titles are jokes. This refers to the postcard from. So I'm looking at the title and it says, you know, 60 years between Bell 103 and today, ! Internet, and all of those are inside jokes for episode 262.
Got to listen to the show.
That's right. So there was a postcard from IBM it had typed on it. This is being typed, written on an IBM selector tomorrow. It was a typewriter today. So that was what the joke was based on. Anyway, so Libsyn requires a secure connection, which is cyber ears never did. So you have to have HTTPS instead of HTTP. And that caused a minor amount of consternation among people who were actually listening to the show on their old computers and no longer could reach it. So that's kind of the topic that I thought would be worth talking about today, is kind of like, you know, how can our retro computers connect anymore? And, you know, what kinds of things are out there? I don't have much of a plan here, but that was what I was, that's what led me to think about it. So we have rcrpodcast.com now lives here. We also did one other thing, which I think, you know, might start the discussion, which is that we also have a Gopher server at gopher.rcrpodcast.com, which does not require secured connections.
Hooray for Gopher! With regard to connecting to the internet with older computers, I feel like the answer is the same as it always is for these types of problems, which is that you put a better computer in your computer. And there are a lot of solutions involving using Raspberry Pis to do all the heavy lifting and then just essentially acting as a server to the retro computer to strip off, you know, it handles the SSL and it handles, you know, the JavaScript and the CSS and everything else, and then just serves the retro computer some sort of very lo-fi HTML 1.0 thing that it can handle. So that's seems to be where we're headed. And then the nice thing about that solution is that as the web continues to get bigger and more expensive and more ridiculous with layers of JavaScript, you can just continue to upgrade the Raspberry Pi, and it will just continue to keep your retro computer going. That's all an easy thing to say. I have not done any of that, so I don't know how difficult that all is. I'm assuming quite.
I think bridge hardware is always going to be a thing for us in the retro computing community if we want to let the old computers communicate. Like, I'm just looking right next to me here is my K-Pro, and it's connected up via serial to a little device called a Y-Modem 232. It's a really neat little thing with a OLED display, small little postage stamp sized color screen on it. And the heart of it is an ESP8266, if I remember right, little Wi-Fi microcontroller that between the RAM and all the rest of it probably has as much or more, I'm sure it has more processing capability than the K-Pro that's connected to, but it's only like, you know, a couple inches wide. It's a neat little bridge though, and it's not obtrusive. And the way that the K-Pro connects is very similar to the way it did it in the day, even with the AT commands from the old Hayes modems. But the reality is that I have to use a more powerful device to allow the less powerful device to communicate. And that's just going to be a thing. And I think that's been a thing for a very long time. And I'm not sure needs to be, you know, thought of as cheating. Because, I mean, when you think of it, even back in the day, if you were communicating with something like CompuServe or whatever, you were talking to bigger, more powerful computers with your little computer. And that was okay. We didn't have a problem with that.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Any form of getting any computer from the 1970s or early 80s onto the World Wide Web is cheating. They weren't designed to do that. The thing didn't even exist then. So even if we were, like, the idea that an Apple IIe was a couple years ago, like surfing the web or whatever, it would have been a kludge regardless. So it's just going to be a new kludge. I don't think it's a big deal.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's one aspect of the, like, if you plug something like, like some sort of bridge thing that will, you know, successfully retrieve the Facebook.com page and, you know, send it decrypted and send it over, a normal unencrypted connection, then what does your Apple II do with it? I mean, it's just like, it's like more, it's megabytes of junk that it doesn't know what to do with.
Yeah, that leads into what I was going to say, which is that we used to say that SSL was the death of retro computers getting connected to the internet. But I don't think that's true anymore. Like, that's easily solved with a Raspberry Pi or an ESP or something like that that can handle the HTTPS. But now it's the layers and layers of CSS and JavaScript. I mean, Anyone who does any bit of web development or WordPress stuff has no doubt surfed the web with the developer view open in Safari or Chrome, and you see just the like megabytes and megabytes of layers of style sheets, most of which are pointless, but it's all there, and it all has to be downloaded, and it all has to be parsed because it's all text. And just parsing that volume of text is out of range of possibility for a retro machine. So, we're getting to the point where the translation is going to have to be so elaborate to produce something that even like an Amiga or an Apple IIgs can hope to render that I'm not even sure you'll be able to do that.
Yeah, well, the thing is, it's sort of like the Sara Lee of document development. So, as you said, layer. It's not even going to get to near time, let alone real time. The other thing is do we make sure that we maintain a plain old telephone system so that we can use our dial-up modems to get in and hop onto our Gopher server? I can't even do that these days because of the wonderful implementation of national broadband here. I've gone with Mr. Musk's little satellites flying around the place.
Has anyone tried using a modem over voice over IP? I've heard that it doesn't work because it compresses the bandwidth they compress the frequencies that the modem needs or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one of the problems. But
we had to switch to VoIP phones at work, and I can barely understand people. I really don't think it's going to work with a modem. It compresses it too much for humans.
I don't think that's really something you can blame on VoIP, though. I have the same issue here. You find out that the problem exists when you actually end up talking to them without using VoIP.
the reason I phrased it that way is because even like actual analog landlines are gone. Mm. Like even if you have a landline in your house, it's not a real landline anymore.
No.
It's just they're connecting it to a VoIP system, which is why even analog phones sound 10 times worse than they did 20 years ago. But I guess the reason I ask is that if it is possible to do that, then it should be possible to route it through a cell phone. But I kind of feel like probably not. Like all the compression and the packetization and stuff that they do is probably going to wreck the signal to the point where the modem on the other side can't understand it anymore. Maybe the lower speed stuff, like maybe you could do 300 BPS where it's a lot less, they're using a lot less of the bandwidth. So it might be close enough to be interpretable. I don't know. I'd be interested to try that.
Yeah, I think so. One sort of obvious thing I should put in here is Fujinet does kind of do a lot of that sort of thing. It is a project that is, that is basically, it talks to the web and parses it and feeds, sort of like retro computer sized information to your retro computer that's plugged into it. So it does all of the SSL stuff. It parses the JSON and you just ask it like, well, what's in this, what's in this tag? And it will tell you rather than having to parse the JSON first. So you still have to know, the API that you're communicating with, but in a certain sense, it's not letting you browse the web, but it is giving you access to sort of modern API. So you could ask the weather station what the weather's like or whatever.
Parsing the JSON is a phrase that always makes me think it comes from like a William Gibson novel.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it sounds like. Oh, I'm out there parsing the JSON. Yeah, you're making up these terms. Whatever. I'm going to hack the Gibson.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the cool things about Gopher, though, is that it puts the focus back on the content. Mm-hmm. I mean, the web is so much these days format and beauty over the actual content that you're going for there, that something like Gopher just can't afford to do that. Text-based protocol, even if it's with a graphical-based renderer, I found that Windows 10 in the App Store even has a Gopher client that you can go get for it, which really surprised me. And it's what I rendered the new RCR podcast site with. And it worked, and it was pretty neat. But in the end, it's just text and titles and kind of nicely formatted, best you can do with ASCII, which was perfect. And go get what you need. And, and ASCII was invented in 1963, so this is even applicable.
Yeah.
Well, not invented, I guess finalized. Wasn't it finalized? Yeah, look at this. If you're watching on the stream, you're seeing what I imagine is a Gopher site that is up and running. And
yeah, this is the Fetch client, P-H-E-T-C-H, just running in my terminal.
Looks very mainframey, but easy to arrow around and get the information that you want.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if you can't draw it in ASCII, is it worth drawing?
Right.
Just for giggles, I opened a terminal on my modern Mac here and tried Gopher, and they no longer include a Gopher client in the Mac OS install. I think they used to, and there certainly like there certainly was in any standard like BSD Unix install used to have just a Gopher client that you could just use on the command line, but that does not seem to be there anymore, which is kind of sad.
Mm-hmm. You can install links and you can install stuff. This was fetch, but yeah.
Well, just to see what would happen, I just typed brew install Gopher. I forget, it's gotta be something. Yep. I'm getting a Gopher client. Cool.
Nice.
Don't know what's currently being installed, but I'll take it.
You hope you're getting a Gopher client.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and you're getting gigabytes of who knows what else.
Nothing like doing brew. A random brew install without looking ahead.
It could be a real Gopher.
Give it to me. Give me what you got, baby. Mm-hmm. So I will report, or I will shortly be off camera.
You'll have 16 new versions of Python and Ruby installed for some reason.
Yeah. Though actually, there. First of all, floodgap.com has a Gopher proxy, so that if you want to use your web browser, you can browse the Gopher web with that. But they also have a plugin for Firefox that lets you just go directly to a Gopher site. But yeah, so I mean, what I put on the RCR podcast place is you can, if you want to actually listen to these episodes in MP3 format, not sent over an encrypted connection, they are all there, and also the episodes in A2Stream format are a couple of them are here, but that's where they will be in the future as well.
Shouldn't they be encoded as MP33.3?
Yeah, MP45s. What else? I actually managed to get a little Fujinet device for the Apple II. Plugs in the back of the 2C Plus I have here, and I was able to boot into Total Replay really quite quickly. I mean, like, started it up, and within 60 seconds, I had the flash screen up, and it was all downloaded over the net. And that's basically all I've done with it, but it works, and it's cool, and it would
that
be interesting
cool.
to write a Gopher client for it. I mean, I think you could probably do it in not very much space because it handles so much internally.
But isn't it cheating sort of using that kind of connection and technology, but with our broadband connection speeds? Shouldn't it be throttled back to 300 or 1200 just for the real experience?
Well, the computer can only parse it so fast. But,
right.
Well, we'll just increase those loops so that it brings it down to a more unacceptable speed.
Yeah, I guess it depends a little bit. I mean, like, if you were the kind of person who enjoyed installing Mac OS 8 on, like, 35 floppies, then maybe this is not for you.
Let's see. I think maybe the last operating system I installed off floppies might have been NT351.
Mm-hmm. So that's probably several.
Mac OS ones, I think I only ever did from... Actually, no, I did a CD one of floppy disk images. Yep. No, I think that was 7.5 or something like that.
I did 3.5.1 on floppies when we were touring around getting NT set up for the company I was working for. Out of 27 floppies, I'm not lying, it failed on floppy number 25.
Oh, no.
And it just would not read, wouldn't continue, got to, it's just, what a nightmare. I don't want to think about that.
Yeah, but at least it didn't say when you got to 27 to put one back in to do your re-verification that then disk one failed.
And then after all that work, even if it did work, you've got Windows, which maybe it's better that it failed.
Are you sure it failed?
Yeah. Maybe that's just Windows.
Yeah, I've got a soft spot for NT.
Earl, didn't you have some kind of a nickname or something based on swapping floppies? I did, yes. The European folks, because we got over there and instead of having a CD-ROM, which we were supposed to have, they ordered the wrong thing and they had it on floppy. It did indeed fail on like number 25. Mm. And after sitting there the livelong day swapping these 3.5-inch floppy disks, they nicknamed me Swappy. And that stuck. So from then on...
Oh, it's coming back.
Whole, yeah. So, yes, Paul, thank you for reminding me
bringing
that
back up.
Other
how
part
we, how
of,
do we change your name on screen here?
The trauma.
I was going to say, update Ultron. Update Ultron to Swappy.
Swappy.
I was thinking about that the other day. So, I mean, playing Apple II games on multiple discs, you did a lot of disc swapping, and you got... Does anyone remember that you got very, very fast at that? Like, I remember being able to swap them just... So, like, it was just muscle memory, how fast you could do it, and it was just blinding. And I remember being annoyed going to the 2GS and the Mac that had a power inject and eject on the floppy, because you had to wait for that. Like, it was slower than you could do it with your wrist. So, yeah, that used to annoy me.
So what did you prefer doing, swapping between two physical discs or flipping one disc? I was better with swapping single-sided discs.
That's a good question.
Because you could do that two-handed, so and then knock the door down. But
I think it depends which Apple II you were using. Because on the 2C and the laser, I had the laser. The drive was facing sideways, and so it was actually, I think, quicker because it was sort of a sideways wrist action, which was very quick.
I must admit, I did most of my wizardry on Euro Pluses, so I had the floppy drive in front. So one hand to take out, one hand to put in, and then as you put it in, the thumb smacked the door down. So and then you're off. Watch out, Werdner, here I come.
Well, and with the 2C, you could have the extra, the second floppy sitting on top, so it was very quick to swap because you could pull one out, drop it on the desk, and grab the second one off the top and fire it back in. And then while it was loading, you'd swap them. So if you're swapping between two discs or you've got four sides there all within like probably 20 milliseconds access time of human swapping the disc there. Yeah, it was pretty amazing how fast you could get at that.
Yeah, and it's still faster than point, click, drag, drop those floppy disk images these days.
Yeah, it's way harder to change a disk in Virtual 2. Like, I have to remember how to do it every time, and you drag it, and it doesn't work sometimes, and, I got to restart, and I got to set the menu option to have that image installed, and so much worse. And for the audio listeners to the show, Earl has, in fact, changed his screen name to Swappy. State that for the record.
Yes. If you work with Randy on Floppy Days, you can, that one episode could be called Swappy Days.
Wow, that's a deep cut. It's like three people in the world that get that joke.
Yeah. All right. Let's see. Yeah, well, anyway, I guess I'm sort of, I'm mildly optimistic that maybe this Gopher thing could, there is a pretty large community already out there doing Gopher, and I'm only seeing the edge of it, so...
But yeah, it's like you said earlier, it allows you to actually get to the content, because just playing through our Gopher site, they're so much faster to actually get to the information, and it's amazing to me how quickly you're not missing all the graphics, you're not missing there, and you go, well, God, there's actually more information on the screen with the Gopher than there is with www.
Yeah, I think there's no question that Gopher is an excellent candidate if we want to build some sort of retro parallel universe of the internet. I mean, yeah, Gopher is an excellent way to do it, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Yep.
Yeah, I think I'll have to put a Gopher side on my retrospective site. Maybe I'll get a bit more enthused to blog Gopherly. So that'd be glogging?
I hope so.
Gogging?
I hope so.
Goofing? Goffing?
Yeah.
Goofing.
Goofing.
I'll do some goofing.
That's like tweeting and tooting, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You
yeah.
goof. I goof. We all goof.
All right, we've sufficiently conjugated.
I could goof.
I could go for some gopher. I'm assuming that, like many of us, my first experience with the internet was Gopher. Like, we had VT100 terminals in university, which is what the first years were allowed to use. And Gopher was all they could handle. So it's the same issue for retro computers. That's what they can handle. So it's a perfect candidate for that.
Well, we'll see. So we have, you know, this is sort of the announcement of the Gopher site at rcrpodcast.com. If you happened to check it, you would have seen that it was there. But we'll maybe try to keep stuff going on there and try to keep the lo-fi versions available for people who actually want to listen to it on their, you know.
Yeah, and if the balances tip, then we'll basically sort of like put them on the Gopher only and then sort of like catch up on the web version.
Maybe we can make ASCII renderings of the YouTube stream.
StreamYard.ASCII.
The burning question that everyone wants answered is, has Carrington's Brew finished installing Gopher yet? My money is on no.
No. No, it turns out there isn't a Gopher client you can grab that way.
Oh, okay. What did it install?
See, that's the question. I was like, okay, what are you doing, Gopher, behind the scenes?
He's been Rickrolled in ASCII.
Because I just did this. I just started the same thing, and it's installing something. So
it's installing. Yeah, we'll see how far you get. And then it wants me to say, how about gperf? I'm like, that's a totally different thing. What are you doing?
Mark in the chat says that Gopher weblogs are called flogs. So there you go. We will all start flogs.
I'm not flogging it. No.
Mixed feelings about that particular portmanteau.
Yeah, it does seem like it's some form of self-punishment to publish by Gopher, but.
Yeah, I guess it's poetic in that sense.
Okay. So, we will continue if developments happen on our Gopher site or we have other retro connection ideas, we will bring those back up. But we are attempting to contain this in time. We will see how well that works. So maybe I'll move to the feedback, unless anyone has a further thing they want to say.
Gopher feedback is spelled with a PH.
Yeah, I hope so. So Retro Recipes has quite recently published 8 days ago as we record this century's first 100% new Commodore 64. This was Tony sent this to us by email. Earl, did you see this? You might have.
I did. I did watch this video. It was very interesting. New keycaps, new case, new guts. Most of the chips replaced by modern counterparts. A couple of the chips didn't have a replacement, but he used another board. And I don't want to spoil everything about the video in case people want to see it, but he used something else toward the end to get around that issue as well. I mean, the bottom line is that the old hardware is failing, and so many modern replacements based on...
I know the feeling.
FPGAs or yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, other modern replacements for these chips that you can't get anymore have come about that now people are having the idea, why not just make a whole brand new thing? Mm-hmm. With all replacement chips, replacement SID, replacement video chip, replacement RAM, and you actually can, and it's pretty fun. And it's not really an emulator in the sense that it's using the same essential circuitry of a Commodore 64, mm-hmm. and in the same way, it's just using a modern chip that is a functional-like, as opposed to... it's not something, in other words, like the Mister, which is, mm-hmm. although a hardware emulation, doing a complete thing in FPGA. This is actual individual chips connected up to each other, acting like the old chips. And so you can make a brand new Commodore 64.
Were there any compatibility issues with it?
Well, I don't know about the end product that Retro Recipes, that Parafractic made in this video. Hmm. He didn't really go into that. I know that with the individual chips, there can be things that are more or less compatible, depending on how edge case it is, the software that you're running. Like, people will say that the SID functional likes don't sound exactly like a SID. So if you have a very trained ear and you know exactly what a SID chip sounds like and you're listening to one of the modern replacements for it, you probably could tell that it's not exactly a SID, but close enough.
Yeah, well, I'll still use my CDs over my LPs, but I know where they're coming. But yeah, it's great to see a new implementation of this. Just on an individual chip level here in Australia, on one of our email list groups, there's been discussions on availability, or lack of availability, and pricing of various chips, and sort of getting the nearest functional equivalent, and then making an adapter. So the new stuff is normally SMD, so you can make some kind of adapter to plug it in place. You've got issues with voltage and whatnot. What can it handle? But it's got to that stage where we can't even get multiple old machines to have them do organ donor job into one working machine, because the stuff, as you said, the stuff is failing. It's not available. If it's available, it's frightfully expensive, and you're also open to cloning fake clones of those chips more so these days. So yeah, I think it's a great little exercise, and if I was to get a Commodore, that's probably the way I'd go. Preferably someone else to make it. I've got too many projects unmade.
That brings up my question, which is he selling these as a kit, or like, what about the PCB? Did he buy that from someone, or was this just like a proof of concept, like, hey, look, you can actually go buy all the parts to do this now?
It was the latter.
Okay.
He put it together with from various sources.
Okay. Does he have there you go. I was going to ask if he has like all the parts listed somewhere, like a shopping list, if you wanted to try this yourself. And yeah, it looks like there it is. That's cool.
Yeah. So it's kind of like an assembly and demo video, but you could do it yourself. Though I sympathize with the idea of I might rather have someone else do it for me.
I mean, I think the main board that he was using is a new one that has just come out, and I can't remember the maker of this new, but it's pretty freshly available. And the main board itself has some of the features of the Commodore 64 integrated on it. There you go, the Evo 64.
Okay, so that was maybe the last piece that was needed to make this possible?
Some pieces of the 64 functionality are integrated onto the main board, some are not. And so you do have to complete it with other components. The interesting thing about this particular main board is there's even going to be a hand-tuned vacuum tube option for the SID amplifier on this, believe it or not. I would love to see one of those things in action.
I have to admit, I kind of love that. It's ridiculous, but I sort of love it.
Very steampunk sort of thing, but
I want to make fun of it, but I literally just ordered a vacuum tube preamp for my turntable, so I don't get to make fun of hipsters anymore, because I am now an insufferable hipster also.
There was a Apple II, like a Mockingboard clone, I think, that had a vacuum tube on it too. That was one of A2 Heaven things. Okay, the Mockingboard T is the Mockingboard with the tube amp.
Is there a picture? How does it fit onto the PCB? Because that goes inside an Apple II, right?
Yeah. For some reason, it's a very small picture, but you can sort of see it.
Right? Oh, there's two little tubes there. Okay. Oh, wow. Those are tiny tubes. Wow.
It'd be more fun if it was a big one. It just melted a hole right from the top. And that's
I was expecting the kind of tubes from the old radiogram days.
Right.
Yeah.
As in having, you'd have to warm up your Mockingboard before you turned on your Apple II.
Yeah. Right. Well, yeah, the phono preamp that I just bought takes 30 minutes to warm up, which is...
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Again, ridiculous, like a ridiculous thing to own, but here we are.
You have become the ultimate hipster.
Yeah.
Congratulations. Achievement unlocked.
That's sort of gatekeeping the young hipsters out, because they couldn't wait 30 minutes to do anything.
Yeah, no. I tried to explain to my nephew, because he's only ever experienced streaming, that you used to have to like wait until the thing you wanted could be watched. And then sometimes there was nothing that you wanted to watch.
Yeah, right. Behave or I'll make you play your games on a Commodore 64 and you'll know all about wait time.
Anyway, yeah. Interesting. And, you know, it seems like it's more likely this, newly fabricated Commodore 64 is more likely to like keep working.
That's true.
Okay, let's see. Next thing is another thing that Tony sent us I think I'm, well, okay, there are three things, and this is the second of them. The first two were sent by Tony, and this is the Go Floppy Drive. Have you seen this? It's basically like a GoTek. It's not actually a GoTek drive, but it's basically like one. But it's in the form factor of a 3.5-inch floppy. It's thicker than a 3.5-inch floppy would be, but it is it's just cute, basically.
Heresy to go to this modern technology 3.5-inch disc stuff. 5.25 forever. They're new enough for us 8-inch disc users.
There's a little window here that you know that displays the label. And I think he made some effort to actually sort of make it match, so it looked like it was written on the disc label.
Actually, that's an interesting use for those e-ink labels. I've seen them popping up on a few places. I've been looking for a use for e-ink labels.
It's pretty cool. I still think it would be pretty wild if you could actually make a drive that you could, you know, like some sort of flash drive that you could actually like stick in an actual floppy drive and let it read, you know, like feed it the magnetic stuff that it's expecting.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that too. Like the CD adapters do for like for cassette adapters. Yeah, I wondered if anyone had ever done that for floppies. It seems plausible for a 3.5-inch to do it.
Yeah,
yeah. I've got a 3.5-inch disc reader that you put the memory card in from, say, a QuickTime 200. So you stick the card into that, and then having the appropriate Mac OS or Win95, Win98 drivers, you can then read the card via your floppy drive. Can't be a USB floppy drive, but yeah, so that was a lot of fun getting that to work. But yeah, I would love to have something like this.
So it didn't actually emulate the floppy, but it used the floppy disk drive with a special driver?
It used the floppy disk read head to actually to read the card.
Oh, that's cool.
Okay. Well, to take the data in from the card. I'm not quite sure exactly how it works. Probably could go in and find out, but yeah, you just take the card out of your camera, slide it into the 3.5-inch disc carrier, make sure the batteries use the standard CR2032 batteries, and then just pop that into your floppy drive, and then you just open up the pseudo disc in your image package, and off you go. Just as if it was tens of megabytes of data on the floppy disk.
That's neat.
Mm-hmm.
Or in the case of the QuickTime camera, a massive 4 megabytes of data on your floppy disk.
Yeah, the custom driver, that's a clever workaround to the problem of having to, like, you know, have the spinning disk and then fake, you know, what the drive head is expecting to see. That's neat. That's a good idea.
Mm. Yeah, so it's just like tickling the drive head with data, so...
The chat says that it's called a flash path adapter.
Yeah.
Did not know that existed. That's cool.
There are people out there toying with my lack of ability to remember things. So, yes.
Ah, yes. And now we have it on Wikipedia, as inevitably we do on this show. Is look at Wikipedia.
That's cool. Yes. Yeah, okay. This is very close to that idea, though. I mean, like, the only thing it's not actually handling is the sort of, like, movement of the head, right?
Yeah, well, you'd have to actually have a thing that interfaces with the motor and detects the spinning, and then based on that, shows the right, you know, magnetic presence at the window, which that would be very difficult to do, I think, in the space that you have inside a floppy disk.
Yeah.
But that's neat, though.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay, let's see. And then the last thing that we got over feedback was the publishing by... Lee Fastenow of Game Boy Tetris ported to the Apple II. I tried it a little bit, but I personally don't have that much experience with Game Boy Tetris. But it's, you know, it's on the Apple II on an actual emulator. It plays the music.
Well, so it's, why is it specifically Game Boy Tetris? I don't think I understand this. Is it because it's green, or is there something else about Game Boy Tetris that's special?
I believe it is the implementation of Tetris on the Game Boy. But yeah, I haven't bothered trying it because it's a game of timing and skill, both of which I lack.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's, you know, it's basically got the graphics that you would expect from the Game Boy and the sound. And the...
Oh, okay. Oh yeah, it's got the same UI and everything. It's, mm-hmm. That's a very niche project. Right. Like, that's not something I would have thought to do, is to port a Game Boy game authentically to an Apple II like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you say very niche, and I was about to say very Quinn.
it's one of those projects that only a very specific person would love, but it's kind of interesting. Looks well done.
Mark says that it plays in double high res with music while playing, which
so
it's, you know, the recognizable sort of like Russian music, right?
Wow, that's witchcraft.
Yeah. Agreed.
Oh, I'm just having enough fun with double high res, let alone getting it to have music at the same time. Oh, I'm color me impressed.
Mm-hmm. All right. Perhaps we can leave that now and move to the items of interest in news. Carrington has the first one, and it comes from TikTok.
TikTok is the best. There's nothing wrong with opening it up on every app and give it access to everything you can. Leave your cameras on all the times, kids. This I found really interesting. It's we're going to link to the Ars Technica article about it, so you don't have to go over to TikTok to hear about it. But Chuck E. Cheese is still using floppy disks, apparently. And so if you're interested in the animatronics at Chuck E. Cheese, and this is a kind of cool story. So how the little animatronic displays work, apparently, is with a floppy disk. So there's a bunch of commands on the floppy disk that tells it, hey, move the right arm, move the head, whatever. And those are still sent, like this person right now, and we're showing on screen, is loading up the 2023 update for animatronics. And that's how it still works. And you'll see above him, there's two drive bays open. Those are for DVDs. So the DVDs are to display video and play music kind of behind the animatronic characters. But the movements themselves are programmed and sent on 3.5-inch floppy disks to this day. So when a Chuck E. Cheese gets a new dance routine or whatever, they receive a floppy disk, they go in the back, they put it in, and that programs the computer, and that's how this runs. And I find it delightful. So this person on screen was saying how this is their last update, and it's not because Chuck E. Cheese is moving to a system that doesn't require floppy disks. It's that they're getting rid of the animatronics. They are ride or die for floppy disks, and the only way to get rid of them is to get rid of your animatronics completely. And I say, awesome, very cool. So it's just so rare I see can you say modern with Chuck E. Cheese? We'll say modern, sure. Like modern, why not? Modern. Any modern company still using 3.5-inch floppies like on a regular basis. And so they are. And so this is a little behind-the-scenes Chuck E. Cheese action. I don't have any nostalgia for Chuck E. Cheese. I think I went once in my life. It wasn't a big deal for me, but I think some people like it. And if you like animatronic stuff, then here, you get a little view here of how it works. I just thought it was neat.
I thought Chuck E. Cheese went out of business. It still exists.
Apparently. Huh. Things exist in other places. I don't know if there's Chuck E. Cheese still here in Toronto, perhaps.
I was pretty sure at least the national chain went under. Maybe
Brew install Chucky.
Maybe there's
Oh no, it's a doll with a knife.
Maybe there's some regional version of the chain still existing or something, but I was pretty sure that they shut it down.
It looks like we still got Chuck E. Cheese here in Toronto. There's a couple near me, apparently.
I guess I'm mistaken.
The other thing that's kind of cool, you know, while we're sticking with the retro theme here, is that on the table in front of this monitor, it seems like we have a, you know, incandescent light bulb and an extender for a telephone, like a wired telephone connection.
Yeah, one of those like mail-to-mail junction.
RJ22.
Yeah.
Jack, yeah, cool.
It's a retro feast for the eyes in this video. Pardon the pun.
Never. I will, if I ever do visit the Chuck E. Cheese that is, I believe, near me, then, which is not that likely, but if I do, I will ask to see their discs in the back and probably get kicked right out.
You've got to be tempted, if you're an employee there, to take one of those discs home, because you know that these are going to be very straightforward, like unencrypted commands on this floppy, and say like, on the last day of my employment, Chucky's got a new dance. He's gonna be dabbing. He's gonna be doing whatever. Be great. That'd be awesome. I absolutely want to reprogram one of those.
Yeah, put down the knife, Chucky. Put down the knife.
All right, Earl, you have the next thing.
I do. PC Magazine in December 2022, I guess, decided to stop the publication of their digital version. I didn't even know that they had continued in a digital format. They stopped the print version of the magazine in 2008. I read this, by the way, on Vintage is the New Old. Love that website. Lots of great news. And it just made me wax a little nostalgic for magazines. I mean, the sustainability part of me is happy now that information is digital and we don't have to, you know, waste a ton of paper to get the information out there. And magazines were also always lagging by 2 or 3 months, the actual tech that they were documenting, but we all just knew that was a part of it. But I love standing in the bookstore in the old days, or the computer store, wherever you were, that had a bunch of magazines, and browsing what was new. And PC Magazine specifically was, I would say, a medium favorite for me. I think that they were technical enough to be useful. By the same token, they weren't as much of a technical deep dive as something like Byte Magazine or Dr. Dobbs, but that was okay. I mean, if you were interested in the business angle and just the general consumer technology angle of this kind of thing in the 80s and 90s, I think PC Magazine was a good choice. I just put this in the notes because I thought it's one piece of the old experience that I kind of miss. Sometimes I sit around and I just think, you know, it was fun going to the bookstore, thumbing through the magazines, even buying the magazine and seeing all the ads. Even the ads were fun because they were about cool stuff that you wanted to buy or wanted to learn more about, or that kind of thing. So I guess they were around for 40 years, started in 82, and then ended their last digital publication in December of 2022. And apparently the website will stick around, something like a tech news site where you can still go and get articles, but it won't be in the quote-unquote magazine format anymore.
So it's sort of like a constant like news site.
Mm-hmm.
40 years, that's a good run for a magazine. That's impressive.
Yeah, I don't think I really read it. I was aware of it, but I don't think I really read it very much. But, you know, it's possible that all of this sort of lukewarm attitude we are expressing here has something to do with why they're not continuing. I'm glad they existed. I can say that at least.
I think with all magazines, the problem is finding new readers.
I wondered if I would wind up being a party of one on the podcast for PC Magazine, because I think most of the other folks here were more into the Apple technology through that time period, right?
Mm. No, actually, for a lot of that period, I was a Windows user.
Mm-hmm.
From Win 95 through to 2000, and that's 2000s when I jumped.
Because I got my first PC compatible, I think it was 1985, something like late 1985, and it was a Compaq Des Pro. And that put me firmly into the PC camp personally for a long time. I guess pretty much forever.
Yeah, early 90s is when I moved from Apple II to PC. And then end of the 90s was when I then went to Macs. So I hadn't really been interested in Macs prior to Mac OS X.
I spent a little bit of time doing programming that was in a Windows, or well, a DOS-based office. It was actually sort of DOS and CPM, you know. But so it was, I don't know, middle 80s. I remember actually being quite pleased with the architecture of the PC and like the drivers that you could slot in, and it seemed a lot more modular than what I had on the Apple II. You know, Apple II, everything is kind of like it's written for the hardware that is there, and you cannot have any alternate hardware because it is in the ROM. I remember liking that. So that was sort of a PC enthusiast for a little while.
Yeah, so the 90s was basically, 90s is where I dabbled with the PC.
Michael, you have a story I guess you were going to just tell us about.
Yes, until I can find the link. Via the CC Talk email list, which I strongly recommend people subscribe to, there was a story of recovering a broken floppy disk. So basically, there was a gentleman, David Vini, who was wrongly convicted of rape in 97, and he sought a new trial, and the state, Maryland, found there were irregularities in the prosecution. So they went back to get the original transcripts of the trial, which they found on a floppy disk. And, of course, being June 2022, the floppy disk was found to have issues, like, how do we read this? That wasn't a simple case of it being a PC. It was actually a floppy disk that had been written to from a DEC PDP-11 using RX-11 operating system. So they went to the computer museum and said, can you read this? So they set up Greaseweasel to read the flux, and then basically they then had the raw keystrokes that the stenographer had recorded using the stenograph machine, so they still needed to translate the stenography into written English. Now, that's not a one-for-one thing, because stenographers, like shorthand, does allow for some customization by the actual person recording the thing. So the idea is that they use standard keystrokes on this, or standard characters, and then when they basically type it up from that. So they had to find a stenographer, but they were actually lucky. They actually found the original stenographer to that trial. So with the text file of the recording, they were able to then create a text readable version of the court transcript, which then basically showed that of the irregularity, so which then allowed him to have a retrial, which then found him innocent. And it was then overturned. So, they reached out to someone who they asked. So, it was, to me, it's an excellent use case of someone being able to take old media and sort of like bring it back in. And here we are with a tangible benefit, for someone to be exonerated from, from a very heinous crime and incorrect conviction.
So, if I understand correctly, the data on the floppy was stored. They used the keystrokes of the stenographer's keypad as the data format to store it on the floppy disk. That's really interesting. So it's almost like a magnetic punch card in that sense.
Yeah. So if you go and have a look at some of the stenographic machines of there, there's whole different styles of them. To like half domes with keys going into it and other various things. And so, they had to sort of like go back and find out what was the hardware that was used, what was the system, they would have got there in the end. But I think, it's just great that they actually sort of, okay, well, we know who was the stenographer, and they went back and they found, okay, A, the person was alive, so that's a good help, and then, they basically got together and recreated it. Now, for this here, they're recreating a court record, so I suppose there were sort of like different things on that. So I'm waiting to sort of see a flux reading of floppy disk being used and presented in evidence at a trial. So, like, what is going to be the chain of custody or what however they want to sort of like do that. So, like, reading that off there. So, how do you sort of like get through and present that as a true authentic translation or rendition of that media? So it's an interesting edge case of the justice system, but I thought that it was quite good. So if I can't find I have the email that was put into CC Talk. I'm going to try and find out if that's available as a blog or a news article at the museum, and make the link available. And if it isn't, then ask them if I can possibly maybe host it on my blog site. But yeah, it made great reading. So if anyone has been just brushing through their CC Talk emails, just go into your email package and just do CC Talk Flux, and you'll probably find it pretty much at the top. Makes great reading. And the follow-on conversation of all other 80-something responses to the original email are very entertaining.
So Paul had it on screen there briefly, but for anyone who may not be aware, what makes that interesting on the keyboard side of it, the encoding part of it, is that core stenographer keyboards are corded keyboards. So it's basically like the one niche where Douglas Engelbart's idea of a corded keyboard actually found a home. And that's because it's incredibly, incredibly fast. And that's how they were able to type and keep up with people speaking in real time. It's because they're corded. So it's a very, very specific skill that they learned to do that. And it's a very unusual sort of niche in keyboarding that doesn't exist anywhere else. So it's a pretty interesting thing. They're not just typing on a regular keyboard there.
Here in Toronto, excuse me, they don't do that anymore. I don't know if it's an all Canada thing or whatever, but this is how it used to be done. But I have a friend of mine who is a court transcriber. So how it works now in provincial courts anyway, is everything's just recorded. And then the recording is sent with a secure thing to a person who listens to it and transcribes the thing and types it out. Using a foot pedal speed thing. She's got like this whole setup. So you have a foot pedal that speeds up and slows down and can reverse the recording and then types it all out. And so that's how it's done nowadays.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah. Actually reminds me a little bit of the, I think last time we had this ad for something that you could hook up to your, I think it was an Atari 2600 to change the speed of your gameplay as you pedal on your exercise bike. And maybe that would be a good way to actually, bring up the fitness level of stenographers.
Oh, yeah, I'm all for bringing up the fitness level of stenographers, but that's definitely not something I'm interested in. No. I don't pedal faster for nobody.
Yeah. Let's see. I guess it's me. I am next.
Before you start, I'm actually going to have to drop out. So, RetroCompute. I'll catch up with you for the next episode. Unfortunately, I've been spotted in my office, and I can't stop this one from coming in. Okay.
Okay.
Take care, Michael.
Bye, Michael.
So, the Lisa, Apple Lisa, has turned 40, I guess. There's various things that are happening about that, but somehow the Computer History Museum has managed to get Apple to let them release the source code. This is they've had many high-profile things. This is among them, at least. You can download the source code and look through it. It looks to be largely in Pascal. Anyway, yeah, it's neat to have it. I think we talked about this before when we talked about their source code project, that I don't know what I'm going to do with it, but it's neat to have it. And they also, they have nice sort of write-up about the history of it at the CHM. And there's an event coming up at the end of this month that's sort of celebrating the history of the Lisa. So, and maybe another thing that's worth pointing out or reminding everybody about is that our founder is working on a documentary, David Grealish's Before Macintosh, the Apple Lisa, which is, I think, just about out. They're shooting for early 2023 to actually play that. So looking forward to that. Maybe we'll have him come back and talk about it when it actually finishes up after he's slept for 3 weeks or whatever it is. There was I did flip through a little bit, and there was there's some references to things in there. Like, I think there was a model that they referred to as the Pepsi, which I'm not sure exactly what the deal was with that, but I think it was maybe a prototype name for the Lisa 210 or something like that.
I'm assuming that's a reference to John Sculley having been the CEO of Pepsi prior to coming
out. Right, that's what I'm assuming too.
Yeah. I wondered if this is a passive-aggressive programmers making fun of the boss kind of thing that they named a bunch of stuff Pepsi in the code or something.
They should have called it the sugar water.
Yeah. Be kind of late, maybe. I mean, I just saw that he became CEO of Apple in April of 83. So theoretically, a lot of the source code would have been cranked out at ahead of that time. So I don't know if the that lines up. Maybe.
Yeah. Because it was, I mean, the whole time that Scully was CEO, I mean, he was relentlessly mocked for being like the sugar water guy. And what do you know about computers and yada, yada. Like that was an extremely, there was so much opposition in and out of the company to him coming over. But that's, yeah, if the timing isn't right, that's interesting.
There's a ton of stuff here, and I don't know actually to what extent you can make it compile. I assume people have tried. Michael in the chat says that it might be in Clascal, a predecessor of Object Pascal.
So, which I'd not heard of before.
Yeah, me neither.
Yeah. I think there would have to be some project I wanted to undertake in order to make it worth like learning how all these pieces fit together, because there are many, many, many pieces. But it actually has all the, not only the OS, but also the applications, you know, like Lisa Draw and all those things.
It seemed like something I read about this indicated, and you'd have to be a Macintosh programmer, perhaps from back in the day, for this to resonate, but some of the conventions of the source code, they recognized as having been carried forward into future versions of what came out for the Mac. And I don't know the particulars of that, but that would kind of make sense.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, I feel like somehow I should be talking about it longer because it is such a momentous thing, but yet I have little else to say. So
yeah, it's a funny thing. It seems like a big deal, and then you're like, eh, like, okay, it's a bunch of weird Pascal for a computer that nobody's ever seen.
Well, Pascal.
Yeah, that's right. It's not even, yeah, Pascal. I mean, it's funny. So this story came up on another site that I read, and all of the comments were basically, oh, great, they released this, but they still won't release the Apple II ROM. Like, we still can't technically emulate legally because Apple refuses to give up copyright to that for some stupid reason that nobody can explain. But now we have the Lisa ROM. Great.
Yeah. Well, you know, the Computer History Museum managed it, so maybe they could manage one more thing.
That'd be great.
But yeah. Okay, Quinn, you have the next thing.
I do. So this is actually related to what we were talking about with, you know, bridging old technology with new technology. So this is a common problem, of course, that we all know about, which is that the batteries in your retro computers leak and they ruin everything in a 3-square-inch radius. And this is, in this case, the Mac SE30 has a battery that sits just above the real-time clock chip, the RTC chip, which in the Mac is not just the clock, but also stores the parameter RAM. And that's the real killer here, is that PRAM, of course, has all of your critical settings. So what tends to happen on these SE30s is when that battery leaks, it takes out that chip with it. And now, even if you replace the battery and fix all the traces, it doesn't remember the clock anymore, but that's fine, whatever. But the real hassle is it doesn't store PRAM settings, which makes a Mac incredibly difficult to use. So there's a story about replacing that, and this being a common problem, there is in fact a community solution for it already. You can buy an ATtiny microcontroller, and there's circuits on GitHub that you can build and a software package that you can flash onto the microcontroller that will emulate the Apple real-time clock chip. And it also, because the ATtiny has static RAM inside it, it will actually also emulate the parameter RAM of the SE30. So it's really cool. It's kind of a drop-in module that replaces the battery and the chip and the clock all at the same time. You can just kind of eliminate all those components. What's interesting about this particular story is that the guy did that with his Mac, and it didn't work. And so this is a series of interesting blog posts on his investigation on why the community's solution did not work for him. And TLDR, the reason that it didn't work is because it turns out Apple used more than one real-time clock chip in these SE30s. there was different versions of it, and nobody apparently knew this until this guy figured it out. And he actually went through with a logic analyzer and determined why the replacement wasn't working in his specific SE30 and determined that there was multiple chips that they used, and they're slightly different. And I was reminded of that time that Charles Mangan did the presentation on the M0100 mouse at Kansas Fest a few years ago, a single mouse model number that was actually like 10 different mice that were in some cases extremely different from each other. So this was a microcosm of that same problem. So there was, I think the standard one was like 20 bytes of PRAM, and then they quietly upgraded it to 256 bytes of PRAM sometime during the SE30 production cycle, and just didn't tell anybody or didn't document that in any way. So this was a very interesting little adventure. So I haven't read the whole blog series yet, but presumably he gets to the point where he figures out how to identify which chip you have, and hopefully the GitHub project can be updated to accommodate both chips. But very interesting problem, and it's an excellent, excellent write-up if you like very technical debugging and problem-solving stories, which I do.
How crucial to this is the ATtiny? I'm wondering, the first thing I thought of when thinking about replacing the PRAM is I thought, well, maybe you could put something that has a Wi-Fi thing on it so that you could change your PRAM settings from across the room without having to...
I'm sure that's possible. I'm sure that they used the ATtiny just because it's a cheap mass market microcontroller that people know how to program and they're easy to get and easy to program. I mean, there's no reason you couldn't do this with any microcontroller, and there's no reason you couldn't do something like you've just said. All it's doing is listening on the pins of the RTC chip for a certain protocol where the CPU is asking for PRAM values and writing PRAM values. So it would, I'm sure you could put an ESP on there with Wi-Fi and have it, you know, access the data that way or whatever as well. You could update your PRAM remotely. The other interesting thing about this story that I liked is that the way he was able to debug this was by using a reference from the day. Inside Macintosh Volume 3 actually documents the protocol that the CPU and the RTC chip used to talk to each other. And, I mean, that would be very, very difficult to reverse engineer. So it's a good lesson that when you're debugging this stuff, that the documentation, the contemporary documentation of the day is your friend, because you know, I'm sure if you Googled that information, you'd never find it. So you have to go to a dead tree book from the time to get that information. And it's easy to forget how good the technical books of the time often were, because people back then needed that information too. So it's a great story, I think.
Cool. I wonder, the Inside Macintosh books, you know, they were just like, they just kept adding more to them as they kept adding more modules to the ROM and stuff like that. I wonder if actually the revision that they did partway through the SE30's run was documented in like, you know, 7 or something like that.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I don't know. I mean, as Apple went on, they got worse and worse at documenting that kind of technical detail. So, I mean, yeah. Nowadays, you can't find that information about your MacBook Pro. They don't obviously document that stuff anymore. But it would be interesting to see when did the documentation fall off to the point where you can't get that kind of information anymore. I wouldn't be surprised if it was somewhere around the end of the SE30, honestly.
All right. I think we have made it to the end of our items of interest in news, and we will now turn to an interesting commercial. Is that right? I think that's right.
Sure.
I think I'm supposed to say a word from our sponsor, but whatever, it's 2023.
There are no rules.
I adore my 64, my Commodore 64. I cook with it, steam with it, educate and beam with it, my Commodore 64. I pitch with it, catch with it, count my 64, the hats with it, my Commodore 64.
64K memory. At a price that will put a computer in every home, business, and school years before anyone ever dreamed.
I adore my 64, my Commodore 64.
Scotch brand number 33 electrical tape. Just the ticket for most any electrical repair. Scuffed or frayed cords, for instance, can be made safe again by reinforcing them with Scotch electrical tape. The handyman in your house will find it perfect for splicing wires, as well as just about any wiring job. Scotch brand electrical tape has the underwriter's laboratory seal of approval, too. Make sure you have a roll on hand for the dozens of jobs it can do.
So just the other day, my dad says, "Hey guys, let's have pizza." Then he asked me what I want on the pizza. So I said, "Everything. Lots of cheese, pepperoni, spaceships, cars, balls, a helicopter, mushrooms, slides, boss, T-balls, race cars, robots, games, hoops, a mouse, you know, the works." They got the picture.
Where a kid can be a kid.
And we're back. So the host's retro computing gift idea this time is an unnecessary object that's pretty cool anyway. It is, you know how you plug in your little USB chargers to a little, you know, nondescript cube at the end that you plug into the wall? This is a descript cube. It looks like looks like a little Mac classic. It is the Shargeek Retro 35-watt charger. Not too expensive, $39. I mean, it's not like pick them up at the bin at the as you leave CVS price, but
what's cool is the screen lights up, so that's kind of neat. And the color it lights up is depending on like what it's doing. So it'll go from yellow to green to yellow to blue, and then green is supercharging whatever it is. I don't know. It's neat that it lights up and has a little happy face on it. It describes it as like a smart screen because you can change the happy face. Now. What they mean is you can print your own stickers if you'd like and stick them over the screen. So it's an interesting use of the word smart there. But yes, it would be smart of you to print your own stickers and paste them on the screen. I still like the idea, though. I mean, if I'm going to have a little white thing charged to my phone, I'd rather have this, to be honest. I think it looks adorable.
It is very cute.
Yeah.
And in the image that we're looking at now, it is supercharging, apparently.
Yeah, supercharging. I hear, though, that a lot of people are saying you can get it a lot cheaper. It's a site where you want to add it to your cart and go away for a couple of days, and they will come a-knocking. Oh, I see you left that. How about another 20% off it? Like, yeah. So they'll make you an offer. If you're not in a hurry, add it to your cart and walk away.
Okay. Once you're done buying Descript Cubes, we can move to Carrington's eBay auctions.
Yeah, let's sell some stuff to Paul. I don't think anything I've picked this week is worth purchasing. I'll give you a heads up, Paul. I'm not going to make a strong attempt.
This reverse psychology?
Yeah. No, when you see my choices, you're not pulling out a credit card. So this is the first one, and it's actually kind of cool. It's currently bid up to $158. When I had picked it originally, it was very, very inexpensive. A little under 3 hours left to go, and it's a Mac 86, which was an 86 coprocessor card you could stick back in an old toaster-sized Mac, so Mac SE. This was the first thing I had ever been exposed to myself for people that want to run DOS things on a Mac. This was the first one I had ever encountered. We didn't have one at work, but I was working with somebody who had one at their other office. And so this is a little daughter card you can stick in a Mac SE or other things from that period. And gives you a I'm assuming it's a, not even a 286. What would this be? Just an 8086. So that you can run Mac stuff. Yeah, it says it's going to emulate a PCXT. So it's kind of cool. Wait, like back then, there was not the horsepower to do this well in software. So like the whole idea of a soft PC was laughable on an original Mac SE. But this let you run MacDOS, and then it would have a port as well that you could connect a 5 1/4 inch PC drive, the Apple PC drive, and so that would give you access to other floppies. And so it's cool, and it's sealed. When I first looked at it, it was going for like $30 or something, and I was like, wow, that's cheap for this. Now it's up to $158. So if you really want one, it's not too bad, but getting a little pricey.
How does it look? Does it run DOS in a window, or does it take over the screen? Like, how does that part of it work?
I don't know. I only got told about how amazing it was back in the day. So it's a thing that I know about because I kept being told, oh, this thing is so cool I have. So I've always been a little jealous of it, but never got to see it actually run. It's probably terrible. Paul shouldn't buy it.
It says operates just like any other Macintosh software application. I wonder if that is meaningful.
That doesn't sound good.
I mean, like, does it run in a window?
Yeah, like it probably has a host app that knows how to talk to this card and renders it in a window or something.
Yeah. Let's see. Mac 86 was, it had a 10 megahertz Intel 8086.
Put a faster computer in your computer, as they say.
Yep. Nice. I think I'll leave that one, yes.
Oh, Okay, this next one, you're going to want this, baby. The Macintosh TV is my next choice. And it's a very exciting Macintosh TV. It's unlike any I've ever seen before. Now, when you look at the, think about the Macintosh TV, is it's a black computer. That's one of the very exciting things about the Macintosh TV. But if you zoom in on this picture, you'll see it's got an odd sort of shine to it.
Yeah.
It's like, it's because it's covered in black tape. This is not a black computer. So the Macintosh TV was the Mac 500 series form factor. But it was the really cool one in black. This is a computer covered in like black electrical tape. So I adore this. I love the idea someone could buy this and not look at later photos and think, oh, I'm going to grab myself a cool Mac TV. There's a couple of panels from a Mac TV, but if you look at the next photo, so here's the computer not covered in electrical tape. Okay. So technically, it does later show you what you're really getting. I think this is fantastic. So Paul, I don't think you've got this in your collection.
That's true. That's true. Yeah.
So if you've got an old Mac 540 or something, and you prefer the look of a Macintosh television, turns out there's a cheaper way to do it.
Yeah.
Which is just completely covered in electrical tape.
Except it looks terrible.
Yeah.
It looks absolutely terrible.
It's amazing they didn't even try to paint it or something. They went to electrical tape.
Nope. Yeah, crazy. Wow. And this thing's being sold in Canada, so these are my peeps. This is how we roll. I don't know if you've seen Canadian television, but you know, sometimes we're not the highest quality version of things. This is the Canadian TV version of Macintosh TV.
You could use this same technique to turn an Apple II into one of the Bell & Hall Apple IIs.
Absolutely. Yep, you could use this technique on a lot of computers.
At double the price.
Yes. So anyway, this one caught my eye because I'd never seen this before. So it was an absolute original. So that excited me. Is it worth $450 US or so approximately? I don't think so, but so it's different. Next is something I hadn't seen before and I've been reading about it and it's neat. So this is the One Per Desk is actually the name of the computer, the ICL One Per Desk. And it's like a Sinclair IQ, whatever it's called, the one that takes the little
QL.
QL. It's a Sinclair QL. Mm-hmm. It's a version of one of those, but unfortunately not compatible with the Sinclair QL. And it was released in Australia, New Zealand, and Canada as three different names. So we had, I don't remember what it's called here, but this is the One Per Desk, the Australian version. And it's a neat kind of computer. The idea was fascinating. So you've got your Sinclair computer, and somebody looked at desks and said, oh, clearly, we're all going to have telephones. We're all going to have like systems that keep track of all of our notes and like the computer stuff we want to do. We also need like a Rolodex, and let's combine it all into one device. And so it's got a handset. You bring your phone jacks into it. So it is your phone. It is your computer. It is your everything. And then they fumbled every single detail. So when you look at it, you don't realize that it's smaller than you think. It's actually got a 3/4 size handset. So it's like uncomfortably small. So when you hold it, it's like a little slightly miniaturized handset, which is what everybody would want to hold up to their head. It's hilariously small. They tried to fix those little drives that the Sinclair one used with the continuous tape in them, and they got them to be much more reliable, and in doing so made them completely incompatible with everything other than this computer, which had almost no software released for it, so too bad for you. It's a very cool answering machine in that instead of recording stuff, you can bring up on screen a display of the dictionary words that it knows, and you select them all, and then it says those on the phone. So you can create your outgoing message by choosing things like I am on holiday until July 15th or whatever, and the sound that comes out is actually really, really good. What it can't do is record any messages, which is you can say I am away, I don't care. So it's an answering machine that cannot take messages. Like they just kind of fumbled every single little bit of it, unfortunately. But this is neat. And when these things do come up, they usually are more expensive than this. This is missing a thing that plugs into the back. If you look at the back of it, or you can kind of look in the photo, there's like a bump on right now. The photo we're looking at, if you look from the bottom on the right, is a large bump, and that's the it's like a plug-in thing, and that's where your phone jacks go in. So that's the phone side. On the left side of this photo is another place where you could plug in a unit that takes a bunch of ROM cards. And so the software that did exist came out on those little ROM cards. You have little ROM packs, and it would plug into you. It was an optional extra. You could plug that in and then get little other programs, like a spreadsheet or whatever, and they come in those ROM packs. And so this is missing that. But it's also less than half the cost that these things normally go for. I like the name, One Per Desk. I actually like the look of it. I think it's a cool-looking device, but too bad about the tiny little handset and the useless programming. And anyway, something I hadn't seen before. So, and I figured Paul didn't have one of those. Oh, here's another. Oh, yeah, so that's the Canadian one. The Merlin Tonto. So exact same thing, but that was good. And it turns out there's a band called Merlin Tonto. Who knew? And I who would know what that band was named after? So that's the Canadian version of Merlin Tonto, and it was called something else again in New Zealand.
Maybe I can figure it out. Computer phone? Yeah.
Computer phone, which are probably the best name of all of them, because that's actually what the thing is.
One Per Desk is probably the worst of them.
Right, but it's the One Per Desk. So I had not encountered this before, and it was really fun looking at it. And then we also have just a link to Tezza. Great, great. We haven't talked about Terry Stewart in a while, but he's got an amazing collection, an amazing YouTube site. And just like an unbelievable collection. He makes videos about the stuff he has and goes in great detail. So if you're interested in this computer, we have a link to a really terrific video that talks about the history of the computer, how it works, shows examples of creating the message, and you can kind of hear the voice. And it's actually quite good sounding. So it's just the problem is they came up with this idea and began to make it in 1981. And this is a great computer for 1981, but then they put it out at like the end of 1984, or beginning 1985. It's like, nope, you waited way too long to put this thing out by then. So
it's interesting that it was available in Canada because the Sinclair QL was not. So this was the only way to get a Sinclair QL in Canada.
Is get this thing, and then it won't run any Sinclair QL software.
Yep. Or even read any of the discs or whatever they are.
Right. But it's a neat thing, and I hadn't encountered it before. So when I saw it on YouTube or on eBay, I was like, oh, this would be a neat item. If you're interested in weird computers, or somebody might have been looking for a different one of these, you got a computer phone, but you're trying to collect them all, then this is the One Per Desk version.
Does this also mean that Terry Stewart is making videos again? Because he went on hiatus there for a long time.
No, this video is from like a decade ago.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I don't think he's posted a video in years, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's too bad.
Yeah, totally too bad, because everything he has, though, is a treat.
Yeah.
Absolutely fantastic. So that's it. That's what I got for you this time. I sold Paul nothing.
Oh, well. It's okay. My house thanks you.
Okay. Can I at least get you interested in buying some electrical tape?
That's right.
Jazz up some computers you already have.
I will definitely do that. And disc drives.
Excellent. Excellent.
So. You could use beige tape in place of retro writing, I suppose.
Exactly, right?
Yeah. Tape is it's like the Windex of retro computing. Earl, you have the next thing.
Sure. So I saw this, and it looked like it was in reasonably good condition with some yellowing. It's an HP 85 computer. The form factor of this computer always really intrigued me. The computer is kind of wide and long and not very tall, a beige sort of color, unless it's yellowed. This one's kind of yellowed. It has an integrated CRT. It has an integrated printer. And it has an integrated tape drive, which you would use for your mass storage. I know suspiciously little about this computer, other than I just always loved the way that it looked. It was one of the computer models that we sold when I worked in computer retail. The one chain that I worked at had these. And trying to learn how to use it always befuddled me. I would sit there and try to type some things in BASIC, and the syntax was just a little off. And I never quite took to how the computer functioned, but I loved how the computer looked. The typewriter style keyboard, which includes the numeric keypad on the right, has a very nice look to it with darker colored function keys and actually some other flavored function keys in the upper right. I think that looks like red and yellow. And the typewriter was very comfortable, as I recall, to type on. So anyway, the price of this, it's going for $249 or make offer, which I thought was fairly reasonable for these when they come up. It also had, didn't it have a memory upgrade and a ROM drawer in it?
Yeah.
16K added memory module. I think these came stock with 16K. So I believe that would boost you up to 32. Now, the person who put in the auction said it's tested to power on and the screen is functioning, but no other testing was done. So there are no pictures that actually show that. So when you turn it on, I don't know actually what it would look like. Would it come up to the basic ROM, or, you know, could there actually be little lurking flaws? Maybe it doesn't quite work right. Don't know. But not a bad price, especially since you could make an offer. Now, it probably won't be cheap to ship, except, yeah, free standard shipping is what I show here, which would be amazing because these are quite heavy and quite big. So, you know, I would say caveat emptor, but if you're interested in it, I mean, it might be a deal.
Yeah, I'd be worried that that just means they're going to pack it poorly and it's going to arrive in six pieces if it's free shipping.
But. Right. And especially with an integrated CRT, it would be a shame if it arrived damaged.
Mm-hmm. So these are fascinating machines. I think I can speak a little bit to why they're so odd. A few episodes ago, my news item was an epic, like, 50-part YouTube series about a guy who repaired one of these. And he found like 200 chips in it that had gone bad. There's over 1,000 chips in it. And it's the reason that these are so odd is because, you know, HP just was kept making increasingly sophisticated calculators. And they were basically trying to determine, it seems, whether or not you can evolve a calculator into a computer. And this was kind of the end of that line. Turns out the answer is no. What you end up with is a very, very complicated calculator that's not quite a computer. And this is kind of where that landed. So I think that's why it feels so strange to use, because it's very much a calculator user paradigm more so than a computer. But yeah, they are neat things.
Interesting. Was that Curious Mark?
Maybe. That sounds familiar. Could have been.
Did that video? He loves his HP stuff.
Okay. It was literally a 50-part video series. I watched the whole thing. Every video was an hour long. Of him going through every chip with a logic analyzer and finding every single bad transistor in it. This thing was really badly damaged. I think he decided that someone had plugged it into a 230-volt outlet or something, and so it blew up it blew up like 50 random chips out of 1,000. And so he had to figure out which of the 50 were bad, and it was a pretty epic thing. But yeah, these are very interesting machines for sure.
Okay, let's see. So I have, there are two that I'm going to show. One is just comical. I just love the name of this. It is, for the Commodore 64, it is the Final Cartridge 3.
And this time we mean it.
That's right. I don't actually know what it does. Earl, is this familiar to you as a, is it like a copy cartridge or something?
I know it by name. I don't know much more about that. I've never had one. I don't know exactly what they do.
A powerful 64K ROM-based operating system. And I believe there really was a Final Cartridge and a Final Cartridge 2. This is, in fact, the Final Cartridge 3. okay. Anyway, the other thing I have is, I just thought it was an interesting object that I was not aware of. So it goes with the Sharp PC 1500. Is there one in this picture? Here it is. Yes. So it's these calculators you can program, and they have a lot of accessories available. There, you can get a little dock that you put it in that has cassettes and a printer. And the thing that this auction seems to be primarily about, although it seems also to have the printer. And the printer, if I'm not mistaken, has batteries in it that you want to get out. I mean, like,
you do.
Probably you wanted to have gotten them out much before now. But it has a little touch screen thing. It's I assume you would kind of use this for something like a point of sale or something like that. But it is the software board, is what they call it. Makes it sound better than point of sale touch screen greasy thing. And they give you a few overlays that you can use. It does kind of look like they're intending maybe for this to be educational.
This is a kind of a neat thing. I haven't seen something like this before. So for people listening, it's like a grid. It's a resistive touchscreen with a grid on it. And then like the Intellivision controller, you can slide these overlays over top of it that give meaning to each of the squares. And then presumably you can just get the coordinates of each button as they're pushed in software. That's actually kind of a clever idea. So yeah, you could use it for educational stuff or for games or for point of sale or anything where you need a big grid of special purpose buttons.
I don't think it's a display, so I think you know.
Right,
like
it's just a resistive touch layer, but not a display, yeah.
And I've got one of those.
You would probably write things maybe on the paper, on the template underneath.
Yeah, you could probably put a sheet of paper over it and it would function just fine, probably. Because yeah, it's not capacitive like a modern touchscreen, it would be like the resistive type. Mm-hmm. Right, it's just pressure. That's neat.
That is neat. I've never seen that.
I have
three of them.
I don't have any of these. I have a couple of the calculators in the docks, but I feel like I've been in the environment where I might have come across this, and I yet never have. So it must be sort of uncommon.
Mm-hmm. This idea seems too good for this computer. Like, yeah. why doesn't this peripheral exist for, like, you know, PCs or something where, like, maybe it could have actually been used in a point of sale or some other useful environment? Like, it's a good idea. It's just, why did they make it for this computer?
It is in Australia. It is coming out of Geeveston, Australia. Maybe that's why I haven't seen it, is maybe it wasn't in this market. Maybe it was only in Australia and Japan or something. And I didn't say what it was, but it was $40 Australian, which translates to approximately $28 US, and I don't know how many Canadian dollars.
I think approximately 40. Usually Australian dollar and Canadian are roughly parity.
Are they? Yeah. Okay, cool. And that's it. I'll leave it there. Oh, by the way, Michael in the chat said that the Final Cartridge 3 is still manufactured and sold as the Final Cartridge 3 Plus. I don't know if that's a joke or not, but I like it.
Subtitle, no, for real this time.
That brings me great joy.
Okay, now I guess we can go to closing discussions. And Carrington, you are first.
What have I got? Did I put anything in the notes? I closed the notes.
Text adventure.
I bet you I've got a lot going on. I'm a busy and exciting guy.
The dorm text adventure.
Oh, yes, I've got that here. So I've been working on a text adventure I've talked about before in Puny Uniform, and I finally have a release candidate, which is I've been doing this thing for K, and I actually have a copy of the release thing, which is exciting. It's not actually a thing that's going to be sold, but I know people in printing, so I've had them create me some production copies, so I want to have one. So it's called Dorm. I will show you guys what comes in the game, which is cool, I think. I'm excited to have it. So this is a thing I've been working on for K. So it's in, for those who haven't listened, it's in Puny Inform, which is a version of Inform that lets you target old school computers. Like the target for this is a Z3 file. It comes on a disk image for the Apple II. So what you get with it, though, is the outer folder here, which is the little thing that's the disk image. You see it protesting the Apple II. The game takes place at a thing that is essentially Kansas Fest. It's like it's called the 8-bit assembly, but you're going to Kansas Fest in this, and then there's protesters and there's magic and things that might eat you. And so then on the back talks about the game, and it's for software for your Apple II and lesser computers. And then the inside is just the instructions and some QR codes to jump to hints and things if you need them, and then the MIT license. And the stuff you get in the package, you get a bookmark, because there's a bookmark in the game, so it's a useful tool in the game. You get these are the feelies, you get three postcards. It takes place in maybe Kansas or maybe Missouri. Nobody in it can really be sure. So it's greetings from Kansas or maybe Missouri. So it's the first postcard. You get the 8-bit assembly postcard itself. The best 2 or 3 or sometimes 5-ish day in event in retro computing. Come for the Apple II computers, stay for the Apple II computers. And then my favorite one, you get a Yak Memory Systems card, which is a takeoff on Elephant Memory Systems. So, but the discs in the game are Yak memory systems, and the slogan is "Holds a grudge." So, like, instead of "Never Forgets," you get the 8-bit assembly welcome letter that tells you a bit about the event you're going to. You get the event guide. So this is the thing that folds out and is the main thing that kind of tells you about what you're going to be doing, the contests and door decorating, all the stuff you do at Kansas Fest. It's all ripped off completely for this game. And then it unfolds into the map. Spray my mic. So it unfolds into the map of the campus. It's going to show you the kind of place you're going to. And then the game itself, because it was a pain to ship it on 5 1/4 inch discs, it's hard to get those. It comes with a little card here, and so you get a enamel pin, which is a ripoff of the Kansas Fest pins. You get a little enamel 8-bit assembly pin, and then the game itself ships on a little thumb drive that looks like a 5 1/4 inch disc. So
that's
I like
really
this
cool.
thing. So I made the art. I had them print them up with that on it. So when and orient it 90 degrees, so when you stick it in your computer, it looks like you're putting a 5 1/4 inch disc in your computer. So that was fun. So this is the stuff Kay is going to be getting, and everyone who beta tested get a copy of it as well. So so it's fun. It's fun to finally have a release candidate and finally be basically done with this thing. Yeah. So that's it. So it's exciting to get this in my hands. Just like 2 days ago, finally got the whole assembled package.
But no, but it won't be available for sale. Is that because that looks incredible?
And yeah, you're not selling this. Why?
I want that.
I've got a bunch of copies. People who want it, I'll probably just like say, okay, do you want, like, I'll make it available for like shipping costs or whatever. But no, it's not like a game I want to produce or whatever. It's just I wanted to like. So yeah, because it's short run printing, I've got like 50 to 100 of every piece because they had to make that many anyway. I'm like, I need 5. They're like, here's a box of 100 because it takes that. We got to run that kind of stuff off. So, so I have enough to make a bunch of packages, but I didn't really do this as a game to sell. I just wanted to do it as a game to make and play and give something for Kay. So, so yeah, but it's fun to finally have the bits, like to have the whole assembled thing. So that's been fun. And then next month, Puny Inform, which is what this is in, has a Puny Jam. So there's a 1 month jam for making games in this. So I'll probably want to enter that to kind of, now that I know how to use this language. The code in this is so embarrassingly terrible. Like the first time you do anything, it's just like, let me dive in and start coding. And now I'm like, oh gosh. But the game technically works, so that's good enough for me.
Yeah, yeah, I played so a little bit of it. I got past the first puzzle, basically, I think.
Right. Yeah, I was aiming for basically, I'm not embarrassed by it, was the quality level. Like for like a first project, you got to just like, okay, I'm not ashamed to have this out there. So it is what it is, but it's fun. It's a fun game, I think. It's kind of funny. It's been through a bunch of beta tests, so it mostly works now. So we'll see. And we'll have a link in the site. It is also available as just a free thing. Like, so all the stuff is available as a PDF. There's PDF version of Feelies, and you just download the game. So there's a site where you just, once Kay has it, it's just going to be freely available. You can just download it and download copies of everything and just play. You just won't have the physical copies. So that's it. That's the game.
Wow, nice work. That's incredible. Those Feelies look really, really
amazing.
Yeah,
it amazing. Was fun. Yeah, the idea was, because it's a very much an old school text adventure, it's not like very exciting things are being done in interactive fiction now, and this is not one of those. This is an old school, find the things to unlock the door, try not to get killed by teleporting, oh, you got to eat my mouth. Like, it's very much old school Infocom style game. Like, that's what I was aiming at. So because of that, I want it to be old school, like, packaging in a baggie. The baggie is compostable, which is nice. And all the stuff's recycled, so I don't feel too bad about the things that got produced. I wanted to have Feelies. So.
Did you do all the artwork as well?
Yeah. Yeah, but I have a background in art. So, like, okay. Not proper art, but like art on my computer drawing with Illustrator kind of art. So, yeah. So.
I liked the Yak a lot. He looks adorable.
Yes, the Yak is great. The Yak is based on a friend of mine had done a Yak like that, and then gave me a copy of it and let me modify it for the, because I thought, oh, that would be the perfect for the elephant. Let's do Yak memory systems. So,
yeah. Very cool. Earl, any closing notes?
Just one brief one, a shameless plug. Randy and I just released Randy Kindig, I should say. We released episode 9 of Next Without 4, which is a programming-themed podcast for retro computing. And in this one, we do our best to cover assembly language. Mm-hmm. It's an exhausting topic to try to cover, especially in an audio podcast. But you know, I think we did it some level of justice, maybe 10% justice.
Yeah, I'm excited when an episode drops when I see it. I'm like, oh, hey, you guys got a new episode out. So
And this one is a cliffhanger.
Well, it is. Yes. It was. This one went really long because we had a lot of material to cover, so we decided we'd break it up into two episodes. So this is episode 9, part 1, and then part 2 will come out, I think, roughly a month.
You're really going to call it episode 9, part 2?
No. No, it won't be Final Cartridge, 3+. It'll be episode 10.
I think actually in our, long before I was part of this podcast, there, somewhere around episode 4 or 7 or something like that, there are a couple of this is episode 7, part 1 and part 2. And in fact, they're separate things. I think maybe the concept was they only got recorded every month or something. I don't know. If you probably have no memory of this, but
I don't. Earl and I were both on the first show. Do you remember? Was it supposed to be a monthly thing?
I don't know. Had David even picked a prescribed time period to release the episodes, like a cadence? I don't remember that.
Well, we'll have him on when he finishes the documentary. We'll ask him.
Yeah.
Grill him.
Yeah. What were you thinking? But I was, because it's, I was trying to reassemble all of the episodes and stuff like that. And it seemed like, I didn't quite know what to do with episode 7, part 2.
The final episode 7.
Yeah.
Plus.
I'd like to thank you both, though, for the smooth transition to Libsyn. I got both the RCR and the Next Without 4 new episodes seamlessly, and I didn't get a new copy of every old episode like always seems to happen when podcasts touch anything. So both transitions went perfectly as far as I can tell.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, exact same for me. It was just seamless. Hey, you're just over on the new thing. So.
Yeah, I think there was a duplicate of one, but I mean, that is pretty good.
Yeah, RCR duplicated one episode, but still the best podcast transition in history. Even the pros get that wrong. This American Life has done it wrong 6 times, and periodically.
Which is, here they are all again.
It's oh, here's 300 new episodes. Oh, thanks. Yeah. Well done.
Thanks. So I guess this is me, and my closing notes are, most of what I've spent time doing between the last recording and now was, getting the transitions that we were just talking about happening. So, it's been fun hearing though from people who were listening on unencrypted connections when those connections went away. I mean, so sorry that they had to write to us to complain, but,
did they send you letters written in longhand?
Dear sir, but
cursive.
Yeah.
Or possibly faxed.
However, though, I mean, it actually led to setting up the Gopher Space and having the, making sure that it's available. So I think I would like to continue to do that and try to figure out a way that I can actually listen on the GS or whatever. So, Quinn, closing thoughts?
Yeah, I wish I had more exciting retro news. I did succeed in rearranging my office, so there's more space in here now. So I'm starting to get the itch to go get all of my retro computers from my dad's basement and bring them over here. Now that I have the ability to do that, weirdly, I'm actually possibly most excited about the Commodore that I know is in that pile.
That is weird.
Yeah, I know, right? About, 15 years ago, I inherited a Commodore 64 and a huge pile of floppies from an old school friend who was a Commodore person, and I was always an Apple person, and he wanted it to go to a good home, and so I took it off his hands, and it's been in my basement ever since. I've literally never turned it on, so I don't even know what all's on all those disks or anything. I assume the machine works. I'm sure it does. No reason to believe otherwise, but so it'll be fun to just learn how to use it and go through all those disks and see what all is there. Just not knowing anything about that machine at all, it'll should be a fun little adventure. And I suppose a lot of twiddling my thumbs waiting for the 1541 to do stuff, but comes with the territory.
You will be waiting for a while. If there's one thing I could suggest, if you don't have one of these already, there's a nice little 3D printed mechanism you can get to clean 5 1/4 inch disks, to actually clean the surface of the disk itself. Because sometimes diskettes will come up with mold or, other little yuck on the surface, and then they'll gum up the heads of the disk drive when you're trying to use them. And I got one of these things. It's not a trivial amount of work. You take the little thing and you spin it and use maybe some lint-free cloth or something like that with isopropyl and clean the surface. But if you do that, I've been able to get through tons of discs without messing up the heads. Okay. So for an old disc collection that you don't know where it's been, maybe not a bad idea to look at the surface before you start in.
That's very good advice. Yeah, it's lived in a couple of basements at least, so probably it's been stored in a damp environment. I remember at K-Fest one year, we went through a bunch of discs like that. They were all moldy, and we took them all out of the jackets. Like, we picked apart the plastic, the black square part, and took the discs out and took them to the sink and washed them, and then dried them and put them back in and glued the seams back on the floppy disk, and that actually worked. It was a bit extreme. I don't know if I would suggest doing that if you don't have to, but that did actually also work as well once we all got over our fear of opening the forbidden black envelope and touching the contents. It seemed to work.
Well, I guess the advantage of that is if the surface of the disk is moldy, there's a possibility that the internal surface of the floppy disk itself has some yuck on it too.
So. Yeah, that was part of the worry, is that the mold's just going to get on the felt liner that's in there, the cotton mm-hmm. liner. And also, we had so many of them to do that it was also just a time thing. Like, you know, turning each one a quarter of an inch at a time and cleaning the window was just, we didn't have time. We had like 50 of them that needed this treatment. So that's, figured we had nothing to lose by just cutting them all open. So we did, but yeah. But that's good advice. I'll take a close look at them for sure.
Is it relatively easy to clean the head in a 1541? Like all the Apple II drives, you know, just they operate with their, you know, when people are doing imaging or whatever, they operate with the lid off and, you know, Q-tip and alcohol nearby to wipe down the head. But I don't know how easy it is to get into the 1541.
I don't know if I've ever actually done that. It's a single-sided drive. It's probably not too hard for that reason. One of the YouTubers that I watch all of his new videos, Adrian's Digital Basement, he actually has one of the old-school cleaning discs that you can put a little bit
of
alcohol on and then access the disk drive, and it'll run through and kind of clean the head for you. You know, it might not work if the head is too dirty. You might need at that point something like a Q-tip with some isopropyl or whatever. I guess that's something people could send on feedback if you want to. If you have a favorite method of cleaning your floppy disk drives, let us know. The other thing, people would open them up so that they could put some lubricant on the rails. Because that's another thing that can get gummed up is the head movement back and forth.
Yeah, for sure.
Tony Diaz had a favorite method for cleaning the Apple II disk drive heads, which was to lick his finger and rub it on the head. But he always sort of liked to do, you know, to shock people with stuff like that. I guess we've made it.
Pretty good for us.
So that is it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at forum.vcfed.org/index.php/forum/retro-podcast-discussion.81. You can follow RCR on Mastodon at podcasts.social@rcrpodcast. You can join our Facebook group, facebook.com/groups/RCRpodcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network. Very, very pleasing visuals going on as I read this. Please write a review on iTunes if you want. And until next time,
Retro Commute.
Thanks. Poor job.
More charming when we're bad at it, though.
Yes.
Michael was the worst. He was off by like an hour.